Paul gives us a synopsis of evangelism in Colossians 4. So do you have your Bible this morning? Let's read a little bit in Colossians 4 and beginning in verse 2, and then we'll talk about these verses together. Colossians 4 and verse 2, beginning. Listen to what he says. He says, continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. Meanwhile, praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word, to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I also am in chains, that I might make it manifest as I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you might know how to answer each one. Let's stop right there. When I read that passage, it seems to me that the Apostle Paul takes the experience from years of missionary travels and conversations with thousands and thousands of individuals, and it seems to me that he boils it down and distills the essence into three imperatives. And what I want you to note when we look at these three out of Colossians 4, that what he talks about really doesn't have anything to do with methods or systems or marketing or selling or closing the deal. Now, there may be some methodologies and there may be some systems that are valuable in evangelism. But primarily, it's about one individual introducing another individual to Jesus Christ and then letting them make a decision as to what they will do with that. So here's what I wanted us to do in the minutes that we have this morning. I want us to look at these three imperatives out of Colossians 4. And then in the last half of our period, I want us to talk about four things that everybody can do in evangelism. Again, whether you're 8, 18, or 80, doesn't matter. There are four things that everybody can do in evangelism. So let's talk about the three imperatives first. Here they are. Number one, he says, I want you to consider your God. I want you first and foremost to consider your God. Now, here's how he said that. He said, meanwhile, praying also for us that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I'm in chains, that I might make it manifest as I ought to speak. I got to tell you that when I read that, I find it amazing because Paul is saying to these brethren, I need you to help me with evangelism. I need you to help me with evangelism. I find that amazing. And he says, here's what you can do for me. You can pray for me. I need you to pray for me in this business of evangelism. Could you help me? Now, I find that amazing because I think Paul was a pretty good evangelist. I mean, to me, that would be like LeBron James coming to me and saying, Don, could you show me how to shoot a jump shot? I think he knows how to do that. That would be like Peyton Manning when he was at the height of his career, calling me up and saying, Don, could you teach me how to read a defense? Or could you teach me how to throw a football? I think he had that mastered. And so here is the Apostle Paul, and he is the Holy Spirit-filled, brilliant scholar, seasoned veteran, gifted evangelist, church planter, and he says to these brethren, I need you to help me with evangelism. And what I need you to do, he said, is I need you to pray for me. And specifically, he says, I want you to pray for doors of opportunities to be opened to me. I want you to pray that God would open a door of opportunity for me. Now, I want to ask you, do you pray that? When you get up in the morning and pray to God, do you pray to God that that day he will open a door of opportunity for you to say something about the gospel to somebody? Pray for the interaction with your neighbor or with the moms at playgroup or the guy in the next cubicle to you at work or the teacher who teaches down the hall from you at school or your friend at high school or maybe in college. And pray that God will just open a door of opportunity to say something where you can just introduce the subject of God or of faith or of Jesus or of the Bible, of religion, of hope. That's what Paul says. Pray that God will open a door for me. I want you to notice that he doesn't say, look, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pray that God will open a door of opportunity for me to speak to an NFL stadium full of people on an NFL Sunday. He doesn't say that because that's probably not going to happen. But for an opportunity to say something to the person that you work with 5 days a week, or that you live by, or that you go to school with, or that you go to the rec center with, well, certainly we have opportunities for that. And he said, I need you to pray that I'll have wisdom, that I will have wisdom to know what to say. And he talks about that in Colossians 4, that I may know what to say. It's interesting, isn't it? I think probably everybody, if you're in this room this morning and you are of any age, then you've probably had the situation, you've been in a circumstance where you know that an opportunity is being presented to you to say something about the gospel, something about faith, something about your Lord, and you just don't know what to say. I will tell you the place to begin with that is to talk about your life. When you know that door of opportunity is being opened to you, say something about your life and faith in your life and what that means to you. Because people can't argue with that. And see, I think we're uncomfortable with that. That's really not where we want to start. We always want to start here. I want to give you my 7 reasons why baptism is essential to salvation. Well, that's important, but that's not where people want to start. Well, let me give you my 5 reasons why we don't use an instrument of music in worship. Well, that matters, but it's not where people want to start. People want to start with what faith means to you. What does this mean to you? You're talking to me about changing my life. Fine. But what does this mean to you? Start with where you are, because that has credibility with people. People can't argue with that. We have in Temple Terrace, Florida, where I live. I've lived in Temple Terrace for just over 24 years now. In the first week that I was there, I asked Brother Harry Pickup Jr., who worshiped with us before he passed away. I said, Brother Pickup, what dry cleaners do you use? And he told me. So I went to that dry cleaners. I've been going to that dry cleaners for 24 years. I'm a creature of habit. And the gentleman who owned it at that time, he was an older gentleman, and he was a crusty old guy. I mean, he was a grouchy old guy. Oscar the Grouch had nothing on him. But I always got along pretty well with him, and he was always nice to me. Well, he eventually died, and his son, Mark, took over the business. And Mark was the polar opposite of his dad. Mark is a happy, gregarious, outgoing guy, never met a stranger, loves everybody, and he's a joy to interact with. But I went in one day, and something was clearly wrong. And so after we had done our business, I said, Mark, what's bothering you today? And he said, oh, Don, he said, it's my wife. He said, she's been diagnosed with breast cancer. And he said, it's pretty serious, Don. And I said, oh, Mark, I'm so sorry about that. I said, what's your wife's name? And he said, well, her name's Valinda. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, Mark, I'm going to pray for Valinda, and I'm going to ask some of the other people at our church who use your business here that you know, I'm going to ask them to pray for Valinda as well. And I told him, I said, you know, Mark, my wife's never had cancer. I said, but my mom and dad had cancer. And I said, I'll tell you what got me through that, Mark, was my faith and the power of prayer. I said, so we're going to pray for Valinda. So as I'd go in, I'd ask him from time to time. Not every time, wasn't going to every time hit him with that. But I asked him from time to time. And I went in one day and I said, Mark, how's Valinda? And he said, Don, he said, she's been pronounced cured. And they had done the surgery and the radiation. And he said, Don, they've told her that she's cured. And I said, well, thank God for that, Mark. I said, wow, what a wonderful blessing for you. Well, about 2 or 3 weeks later on a Sunday morning, in our foyer of our building, there's a lady staying there, a little tiny diminutive lady. And I went up to her and stuck out my hand. I said, I'm Don Truex. It's good to have you here. What's your name? And she said, well, I'm Valinda Kornheiser. And I said, are you Mark's Valinda? And she said, yes, I am. And I said, well, Valinda, it is so good to have you here. And I said, congratulations on your prognosis. I said, we're so happy for you. One of our families took Valinda under their wings, and they began to study with her. And now Mark, he didn't come study with her. Mark's last name is Kornheiser. He is from a Jewish background. Nobody in his family has ever left Judaism, ever. And so Mark, he didn't come to the studies. When they would study at Mark and Valinda's house, however, the people studying with Valinda told me that Mark was in the next room and he would listen. And then Mark got where he would send questions, but he still wouldn't come in and sit down with them. And then eventually he got where he came in and sit down with them, and eventually, like Valinda, Mark was baptized, and he's a faithful Christian with us to this day. And it all began because I just found a way to talk about my faith in a way that was non-threatening to him and in a way that interjected that into his life. We can all do that. We need to pray that God will give us wisdom to do that. And then we need to pray for God's help. We need to involve God in this process. Who's Paul? Who is Apollos? We are just ministers through whom you believed, as the Lord gave to each one. I planted Apollos water, but God gives the increase. And so God knows, you know, God knows which hearts are open and pliable and willing to hear. And he knows which hearts are hard as stone, even though the person might seem like the nicest person in the world to us. God knows. And so we need to involve him in that process. And when somebody's obedient to the gospel, we need to give God the glory. Give God the credit about that. You and I didn't die for anybody. And so we need to make sure that he gets the credit. So first Paul said, consider your God. Secondly, consider your connections, he said. And here's how he said that in verse 4. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside, redeeming the time. And I want you to notice carefully something. There are some, Paul said, who are on the outside. Look at that. Paul said there are some who are on the outside of Christ. Now, I realize that's not politically correct. I know that. We live in an all-inclusive, everybody gets a trophy and a snow cone kind of world. Everybody's okay. But when it comes spiritually, Paul says, look, God's divided the world, at least the accountable world, into two groups. Those who are saved and those who are lost. Those who are in Christ and those who are outside of Christ. I think it's hard for us to realize that sometimes. I think it's hard for us sometimes to realize that that neighbor who is so friendly, that coworker who is so helpful, that relative that we love so much, the fellow student that is so brilliant, we forget sometimes that if they've never been obedient to the gospel of Christ, they are on the outside. They are lost. So what should we do about that? Well, I think obviously we ought to build some relationships there. We need to build some relationships. Paul said, I want you to walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside. What does he assume in that, ladies and gentlemen? He assumes that we have relationships with non-Christians. He assumes that when you and I became a Christian, we did not start living life in a Christian cocoon where our life never touched non-Christians. He assumes that we're going to share life with those who don't know God. Jesus assumed that. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. What's the point of that? Well, it's that we're to make an impact on this world in which we live. Paul said to the Philippians, you do live, he said, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. But he said, among whom you must shine as lights in the world. Among whom? We've got to interact with that. I think sometimes we feel like, you know what, if we could live in a Christian cocoon, that would be great. If we could live in a gated Christian community and get up in the morning and drive our car and go to a job where there are only Christians. And then on the way home, if we could just stop in a Christian-owned grocery store that was only open to other Christians, that would just be a perfect life. And God says, no, that wouldn't be perfect at all. Because I want you to make a difference with those who are non-Christians. So you got to build relationships with those who are on the outside. And then we've got to walk through those open doors. If you're going to pray for doors of opportunity to be open, when they're open, we've got to walk through those. So when opportunity knocks, we've got to answer. You know, Paul said, I've become all things. Your PowerPoint didn't like mine there. I've become all things to all men. It doesn't mean that he was going to sacrifice his values or his morals or his character. But he is saying, look, I'm going to be positively involved in other individuals' life. That's exactly what Jesus did. You remember that one of the constant criticisms of Jesus was that he eats with tax collectors and sinners. He spends time with people who make us uncomfortable. And Jesus said, guilty as charged, because those who are well don't need a doctor, but people who are sick. And he said, I'm come to help people who are burdened with the sickness of sin and whose relationship with God is not right. I'm coming to try to help them be right with God. And so we've got to build those relationships, and we've got to walk through open doors when they're presented. And when we do walk through those open doors, third and finally along this line, Paul said we've got to consider our words. We've got to think about what we say and how we say it. Now, here's where he said that, and that's in verse 6. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Again, what we say and how we say it will speak volumes to others about who we are. If you don't believe that, if you don't believe that your words and what you say and how you say matter, just think about that story in Matthew 26 when Peter is warming his hands at the enemy's fire, and there's a young servant girl who says to him, you were with the Galilean. And he says, no, you've got me mixed up with someone else. And she said, no, you were. And how did she say, I know that? Your speech gives you away. Your Galilean dialect gives you away. What we say and how we say it, people will recognize something about us with that. So we need to remember that it is amazing grace. What we sing is true. It is amazing grace. How sweet the sound. Yes, the Bible, don't misunderstand me this morning. The Bible says a lot about sin and judgment. There's no doubt about that. There is much to be against. But we've also got to let people know that God's grace is sufficient to forgive them, regardless of who they are, what they've done. That the amazing grace of God is sufficient to make them into something better. And he said, I want you to think about how to answer each one so that you may know how to answer each one. Have you ever wondered why Paul said it that way? So that you may know how to answer each one. I think the reason is because we are individuals. We are not clones of each other. I think sometimes we've had the idea in evangelism that if we could just get the perfect open to make an introduction and then the perfect close to seal the deal, we could baptize the world. The problem is that people are not clones of each other. We've got to know how to answer each one. So some people are very analytical. Have you ever met an engineer? You might have one or two in this audience. I remember your former preacher once saying, you can't throw a songbook in this church without hitting an engineer. So, so engineers tend to be very logical and analytical, and a lot of people are like that. They are very logical and orderly and sequential in their thinking. They want to go from point A to point B to point C to point D. They want it all to make logical, orderly sense. But some people are not that way at all. Some people are emotional, and the story of the cross is going to affect them profoundly, that God loved them that much and Jesus was willing to sacrifice for them. Some people are skeptical, and in their skepticism, again, what they're going to want to know first is what Christianity means to you. I mean, before you talk to me about baptism and instrumental music and why Calvinism isn't according to Christ and all those other things that I know you want to talk to me about, first, tell me what it means to you. You're asking me to change my life, radically so, fine. But tell me what this means to you. See, we have to know how to answer each one. Consider your God, consider your connections, consider your words. I think that's important out of Colossians 4. Now, in the minutes that we have left, if I may, I want to segue out of that. And I want to talk about something that everybody can do in evangelism. I think when we talk about evangelism, it's the one subject that I know when I talk about that the audience, as soon as they see the first slide, evangelism, the audience gets nervous. Great. Here's another preacher going to make us feel guilty because we're not doing enough with evangelism. Well, let me tell you, I'm not much into drive-by guiltings. That's not me. It's not the way I operate. I do want to say to you that I believe that there are four things that everybody can do in evangelism. And again, whether you're 8 years old or 18 years old or 80 years old, you can do these four things. We had a preacher come to us at Temple Terrace many years ago, and we were trying to ramp up evangelism in our congregation. And he talked to us about evangelism, and he mentioned these four things just in passing and then moved on. And I thought, wow, we need to stop and think about that a little bit. So we've taken these four things, and I've elaborated on them a lot. We've put them on bookmarks. We keep them in front of our church from time to time. I preach on these four things once or twice a year because everybody can do these. Everybody can do these. You can. I'll guarantee you. Here they are. Number one, everybody can shine. Everybody can shine. And so Jesus said, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and thereby glorify your Father who is in heaven. Everybody can do that. Every Christian can live a life that is appealing and attractive to those who view and witness your life. That simply means that wherever you find yourself, you live in such a way that the gospel is enhanced by your life and never diminished. Now, the Bible talks about that everywhere. Do you remember in Titus 2? In Titus 2, Paul talked to, he said to his young protege, Titus, look, I want you to say these things to aged men, aged women, young men, and young women, four groups. And he began in Titus 2 and verse 3, and he said, I want you to tell them to live in such a way that nobody can malign the gospel by viewing their life. And then in verses 6, 7, and 8, he said, look, I want you to live in such a way that those who are an opponent of the gospel, when they look at your life, will not have anything evil to say about Christ by looking at you. There's a consistency there. In Philippians 1 and beginning in verse 27, he said, I want you to conduct yourself worthy of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In that passage we just read a moment ago in Colossians chapter 4, he said, walk worthy of the gospel. And it's simply this. It's just showing by your life that Christianity has made a real, practical, tangible difference. That this isn't just theory to you. That Christianity isn't theoretical. It's not just something on Sunday that you've made your weekend hobby, but this is who you are. And it's had a profound difference in you, in your family, in your marriage, in your work life, that you are setting the pace in all of those because of your relationship with Jesus Christ. Everybody can shine. And I think probably everybody in this audience is on board with that. I didn't lose anybody there, I'm sure. But I'll tell you secondly, I think everybody can speak. Now that's usually the point where people get a little skeptical and they say, I'm not sure about that, Don. But let me tell you what I mean by that. I don't mean that everybody can stand in front of an audience and preach the gospel. I don't believe that's true. Not everybody is gifted to do that. I don't mean by that everybody can stand in front of a Bible class and exegete a passage or teach a topic. Not everybody has the ability to do that. We need to understand that. But I am saying that everybody can learn to season their speech with references to God in a non-obstructive, non-obtrusive kind of way. Do you remember what Jesus said in Matthew 10? He said, "Whoever confesses me before men, him will I also confess before my Father who's in heaven." Now, you are good Bible students, and so you know he's not talking there about the confession before baptism, right? If you want that confession, you go to Romans chapter 10. In this context, he's talking about just the confession of daily life. He had said in this same context, "Whoever denies me before men, him will I deny before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever owns me, confesses me, acknowledges me, owns me in their day-to-day life, I will own before my Father who is in heaven." Everybody can speak. Here's what I mean by that. Everybody can learn to incorporate into conversation concepts of God and faith in the Bible and do that in a way that is not off-putting, that is not intrusive, if we will just think about it. See, I think we've so conditioned ourselves to think about evangelism, to think about it in some kind of a formalized, mechanical, methodical kind of way. You've got to have an open, you've got to do the teaching, and then you've got to seal the deal. That we forget sometimes that really the beginning place oftentimes is just an introduction with somebody. In Temple Terrace where I live, about two or three minutes from my house, is a Starbucks. It opened in August of 1999. I remember that because I remember the day, or it was July rather, of 1999. I remember it because I was driving past and I saw the sign go up and I pulled off the side of the road and offered a prayer of thanksgiving because I love coffee and I love Starbucks. So I've been going to that Starbucks. When I'm home, I go in there every morning of the world. On my way to the office, I stop in there every morning of the world. That unit, like so many Starbucks stores, has gone through multiple managers. They turned them over fairly quickly. But they had one manager there who stayed there for a good while. Her name was Wendy. She was from Chicago. And I had graduated from high school just outside of Chicago. I spent my junior and senior year of high school up in that area. And so Wendy and I, we talked a lot about Chicago. We knew a lot of the same places up there, enjoyed a lot of the same places up there. So we talked a lot. One Sunday morning, I went in very, very early. I go to my office very early on Sunday mornings. And I stopped in, and Wendy liked to work on Sunday because it was not busy. She could get a lot of work done, a lot of paperwork and things. So it was just her and me in Starbucks that Sunday morning. And I got my coffee, and I was about to leave. And I said, "Wendy," I said, "listen, I come and see you all the time where you work. When are you going to come see me where I work?" And she said, "Oh, Don," she said, if I went into a church building, the roof would just fall down." And I said, "We got a pretty strong roof." I said, I think it could even handle you, Wendy." And she said, "No, Don, I don't think so." I said, "Okay, well, that's fine." So two or three weeks later, again on Sunday morning, I was in. It's just the two of us again. And I got my coffee and I said, "Wendy, listen, I'm serious now. I come and see you all the time here where you work. And we've been visiting and talking for a long time. I said, when are you going to come see me where I work?" And she said, "Well, I'll think about it." I said, "Okay, all right." So about 2 weeks later, on a Sunday morning in between Bible class and worship, I looked up and there's Wendy in the back of our building. And she's standing back there against the wall and she's just kind of looking. She's taking all this in. So I went up to her and I said, Wendy, I am so glad to see you. It is so good to have you here. And she said, Don, I know so many of these people. Yeah, we're all addicted to caffeine here, man. Yes, you know. And I brought Wendy down to sit by Vicky and me. And she heard about a God who loved her and was willing to forgive her. Now Wendy had a lot to be forgiven. She was living with a man to whom she was not married, and she had other things going on in her life that were not right at all. We began to study the Bible together, just sat across a table and studied the Bible. And she learned about a God that loved her in spite of her failures. And I'll never forget the Sunday that at the invitation, Wendy walked forward, and she wanted to be baptized. We stood in that baptistry. And I was trying to tell the church what I've been telling you, and I was just crying like a baby, you know. And Wendy's looking at me like, look, you got me here, could we get on with it, you know? And she was baptized. 18 months later, I performed her wedding ceremony to a nice young Christian, godly young man. And it began just with saying, Wendy, just come to worship with me. Just come and visit. And it began so simply. You know, ladies and gentlemen, we don't have any trouble talking about things that matter to us, right? I'll guarantee you that there have been conversations in this building this morning, I'll guarantee you already, about children, about grandchildren, probably about some sports. Man, I have preached a ton in Alabama in the last few years. I know people, half of you don't have any trouble talking about Alabama football, half of you don't have any trouble talking about Auburn football, and none of you have trouble talking about the others. Because that matters to us. And so we talk easily about it. What do we say matters to us the most? I pulled up to that Starbucks one morning. I was on my way to the office, and by the way, a lot of my illustrations have to do with Starbucks, which is a clue into what I enjoy. But I pulled up to that Starbucks one morning and things weren't right. It didn't look right. There were two Chevy Tahoes and they weren't in the parking spaces. They were parked horizontally and the windows were completely blacked out. And when I parked, I noticed that there were two gentlemen standing outside of them and they had dark suits on and they had sunglasses and they had earpieces in. And when I went inside, there was another gentleman standing off to the side and he was looking at the line. And he too had on a dark suit, sunglasses, he had an earpiece, and he clearly, right here, was carrying a weapon. And I thought, wow, this coffee is expensive, but I didn't know you had to guard it like that. So I stepped up in line. And the gentleman in front of me had his back to me, but when I stepped in line, he turned around. And he stuck out his hand, and he said, good morning. He said, I'm Rick Scott, what's your name? And I said, well, Governor, I know who you are. I voted for you. And I said, I'm Don Truex. He said, well, it's good to meet you, Don. I said, well, Governor, what brings you to Tampa today? You know, Tampa's a long way from Tallahassee, the state capital. And he said, I'm dedicating a building over here at University of South Florida. He said, I got to give the dedication speech there. But he said, let me tell you, Don, he said, the reason I'm really happy to be here, he said, my daughter and her family live here in Tampa, and today is my grandson's second birthday, and so I'm going to get to go to his birthday party. And then he asked me that magic question. He said, Don, do you have any grandchildren? Yes, I do, Governor. I certainly do. And I took out my phone, and the governor took out his phone, and here we are. And we're talking to each other, showing each other grandkids. And I'll tell you something, my grandkids are a lot better looking than the governor's. But now here's the deal, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't have any difficulty talking to the governor of the state of Florida, who I had never met before, had no trouble talking to him about my grandkids, because those kids matter to me. They matter a lot to me. And we had a conversation like we had known each other a long time, because that mattered to both of us. We say that the most important thing in our life is our relationship with God and with his son, Jesus Christ. And we say that their book is of preeminent value to us and importance, and that his people, the church, matters to us. Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, if that's the case, we shouldn't have difficulty talking about it. It should be easy and natural to incorporate that into conversation. I'm not talking about it in an off-putting way, but in a way that's natural. We We call that at home gentle noise. We periodically offer some classes to try to help people know how to do that, because we should be able to do that. And I'll tell you, thirdly, everybody can invite. Everybody can invite. Everybody can invite. Well, that's the easiest thing you'll ever do in evangelism. The easiest thing you'll ever do in evangelism is to follow this example from John 1. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses and the law and the prophets spoke. This is Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said, "Come and see." That's an interesting passage. "We have found Jesus of Nazareth. Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" It always reminds me that when I was at Florida College, we named the cafeteria Nazareth because nothing good ever came out of there. But I want you to notice what he said. Just come and see. He didn't argue with him. He didn't fuss. He didn't say, "Look, let me give you my 10 reasons why I believe Jesus is in fact the Messiah, the fulfillment of the promise." He didn't do any of that. He just said, "Come and see." The easiest thing you'll ever do in evangelism is to just say, "Come and see. How about coming to worship with me?" You can do that here and know that anybody that comes is never going to be embarrassed. They're going to hear the truth. Nobody's ever going to sand the edges off the truth, but they will speak the truth in love, to use Paul's language. You know, Jesus said, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." And I tell you what we do with that. We say, "Well, you know what? I can't do that. I can't go into all the world. I can't go to India. I can't go to Ethiopia. I can't go to..." And we assuage our conscience and let ourselves off the hook. But what Jesus is really saying is, go into your world. Go into your world, wherever it is that you do life, your neighborhood, your workplace, your rec center, your school, wherever it is that you do life, you go there. And at the very least, you can say, "Come and see." And suppose you invite somebody and they say, "I don't think so. Thanks, but no thanks." Well, is that soul shattering that we'll never be able to recoup from that? I mean, is that rejection so tough that we can't get over that? Sure we will. Just come and see. Come and see. And then fourth and finally, could I talk to you about something that we don't ever think about? Welcome. Everybody can welcome. Now I want you to track with me for just a couple more minutes in the 2 or 3 minutes we have left this morning. Okay? We don't have the time to read it this morning, but if we did, we'd read James 2, 1 through 4. So let me just give you the Reader's Digest version. All right? James says, the context is, you should not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ with respect to persons. And then he gives an illustration of that. You remember what it was? He said, if there comes into your assembly a man and he is dressed to the nines, he has a gold ring and he has really a beautiful suit on, and you say to him, you look at him and say, "Wow, this is an important person." And you say to him, "You sit here in a really good place." And there comes in someone else and you can tell. They're not in that category socially. And you say to them, "How about taking a place here in the back?" He said, you become a respecter of persons. Now that's the context of that. But have you ever thought about the assumption that is there? James uses that illustration, and what does he assume? He assumes that we are going to have visitors in our assembly. Did you get that out of that? He just assumes when he writes this, he assumes that we're going to have visitors in our assembly. How are they going to come? Well, they're going to come when you shine and speak, and in particular when you invite. But now let's suppose that we've got a non-Christian visitor who comes to our assembly. I want you to listen carefully to what I'm about to say. How we treat our guests is going to determine in large measure whether they ever come back. In fact, virtually every study that's ever been done says that a non-member visitor to a local church of any variety decide within the first 5 minutes if they will ever return. So we need to make sure that we've got some things in place from the very time they set foot close to our building. We've got things in place to make sure that they are made welcome. We've got to make sure that when somebody comes in this building, ladies and gentlemen, listen to me, when somebody comes in this building and you don't recognize them, you need to make sure you go up and introduce yourself. Now let me say, I know what some of you are thinking. I said this in a church a while back, and a lady came up to me afterwards, and she said, "You know what, Don? I did that. I saw somebody I didn't know, so I went up and I introduced myself, and they looked at me and said, 'I've been a member of this church for 2 years.'" And I said, "That's great. You met somebody you should have met 2 years ago." Could you think about this with me just a little bit further, ladies and gentlemen? how we treat visitors that come to our assembly, particularly non-Christian visitors. Let's suppose for a moment that UAH, their drama department, is putting on a play. And so you and your wife buy tickets to go, and you're there, and you're in the audience, and you're waiting for the curtain to rise and the performance to begin. And so you're just minding your business, sitting in your assigned seat. And there's a gentleman who walks out from behind the stage, and he comes down the aisle, and he comes over to you, and he says, "Sir, could you come with me for just a minute?" And so you get up and you follow him. And he takes you up the aisle, and he takes you on the stage behind the curtain. And you're standing on the stage now. And the curtain is drawn, but you notice that all the props are in place and all the other actors are taking their place because it's time to begin. And the gentleman who brought you up there, he gets you up on the stage and he says, I'm the director of tonight's performance, and one of our cast members called in sick, and I need you to take their place. And he walks off and leaves you standing there. And the curtain rises. And all the other actors begin to move, and they all know their lines and where they're supposed to go, and they know how everything is supposed to be done. And there you are, and you don't have a clue about what to do or what you're supposed to do or what's going to happen. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a non-Christian visitor to our worship services. You see, you know everything's going to happen this morning. I mean, we're creatures of habit. In fact, most of you are sitting where you were sitting 6 years ago. You haven't moved. You know the order of things this morning. You know how things are going to happen. You're completely comfortable with that. A non-Christian visitor who comes into our building, they don't have a clue about what's going to happen. They don't understand about this singing business and the Lord's Supper and how things are going to go and what the order of things is going to be. And so we've got to be the ones to bridge that gap for them. So you see somebody you don't know, introduce yourself. Invite them to come sit with your family. If they're a young family, have them go sit with one of your young families with kids. Talk to them about what's going to happen. Let them know. Let them know what the order of things is. Everybody can do that. Have you ever thought about the fact that the Apostle Paul once said to the Colossians that the sound of the gospel had gone to the habitable world? How did that happen? I mean, how did that happen in the first century? The gospel went into all the world without a single billboard, no correspondence courses. There was no internet, no Twitter, no Instagram. There were no cell phones. There was no Facebook, no text messaging, no television, no CDs, no DVDs. There was no Bible class material other than the text. And the gospel went to the world. How did that happen, ladies and gentlemen? It happened because one hungry person told another hungry person where the bread line was. It happened because there were people who read the book and loved the book and the author of the book and told others. And that's exactly how it will have to happen in 2018 as well. Everybody, ladies and gentlemen, can shine and speak and invite. Thank you for listening so well this morning.